Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So, you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So, whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publicize your book. And there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Psychoanalysis, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. My name is Matt Pieknik, your host, and I am delighted today to welcome Oliver Davis and Tim Dean, co-authors of Hatred of Sex, published by University of Nebraska Press earlier this year. Oliver Davis is a professor of French studies at the University of Warwick and the author of Jacques Rancière, Age, Rage, and Going Gently, Stories of the Senescent Subject in 20th Century French Writing, and editor of Rancière Now, as well as the journal Modern and Contemporary France. Tim Dean is the James M. Benson Professor in English at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, and the author of Unlimited Intimacy, Reflections on the Subculture of Barebacking, and Beyond Sexuality. Tim, your work has long been engaged with psychoanalysis, particularly the work of Freud and Lacan, and both of you have written significantly in the areas of queer theory and sexual cultures and practices, all of which form, along with the work of Jacques Rancière, the major foundations for this book, Hatred of Sex. Tim, Oliver, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you for having us, Matt.
Yes, thank you for having us.
Before we start, I want to say that this book seized me in a way that no book has for me since what we've started to call the before times. It touches on something of the zeitgeist, I think, right now, both sexually and politically, that feels very urgent and very unsettling. And it lends some language and organization for me to some of the very disorganizing phenomena that characterize this moment that we're all in right now. It was being seized this way that excited me very much to do the interview with you. So at New Books in Psychoanalysis, we always begin with the same question. To the extent that it's possible to know, what were your conscious motivations for writing Hatred of Sex?
Well, Matt, thank you for asking the question. Thank you again for having us on your show. I had both intellectual and personal motivations for wanting to write this book. Intellectually, I wanted to learn about the philosophy of Jacques Rancière from Oliver, who knows Rancière's work much better than I do. And I wanted to explore whether Rancière's ideas were in some way compatible with psychoanalysis, as I understood it. That was my sort of wager going into it. Personally, though, you know, I wanted to deepen my connection with Oliver. I had never done a collaboration at this scale before, and I wanted to see if it would be possible for us to write a whole book together. Psychoanalytically, I would say that Oliver and I made a baby without having sex.
And in my case, I would say the motivations were overdetermined, a confluence of several concerns. Similarly, as Tim has very generously said, I wanted to learn from him and his long experience of psychoanalysis and using psychoanalysis in queer sexual cultures, particularly. But I suppose my kind of intellectual, conceptual, ethical, political motivation was primarily a sense of frustration that despite the gains that have been made by the lesbian and gay liberation movement since the 1970s, and I'm using those terms advisedly because I think trans liberation is still very much in a battle in progress. But despite those gains, it seems that in the last 50 years or so, there's been a kind of significant proliferation of concepts of risk and danger, and these have come to gravitate around sex in a very problematic way. Governing power has learned to harness fear of sexual risk and sexual danger. And a lot of kind of well-intentioned movements, campaigning movements, for example, to eliminate child abuse, to eliminate violence against women, these have had kind of cumulative collective side effects, if you like, that have spilled over into the culture and seem to betoken kind of together a kind of reversion to a sort of primitive sexual puritanism. And so it was a sense of frustration at that sort of backsliding, if you like, or that kind of paradoxical movement. And for me, that was something that there is an edited volume by David Halperin and Trevor Hopp, The War on Sex, which Duke published in 2017. And many of the contributors there, particularly the criminologists, I think, take issue with some of the kind of phenomena that that I've just mentioned. But I think it seemed to me, and I suppose it seemed to us, that there was a lot more to say on the matter, particularly from, if you like, a kind of from a psychoanalytic and from a sort of social and structural perspective that perhaps, you know, that volume had less to say about, but we felt we could say something significant on.
As a way of getting into the book, I want to ask about Rancière. Now, Oliver, you are a scholar on the work of Rancière, and especially his book, A Hatred of Democracy from 2005, is a central reference point for this book. Obviously, they share partial titles, Hatred of Sex and Hatred of Democracy. So for our listeners who are maybe unfamiliar with Rancière's work, can you tell us just a little bit about his concept of hatred of democracy and how it relates to this project?
Yes, of course. I'll try to tell you just a little bit because I've spent a lot of time working on Rancière over the years, and I've got a couple of books on him. So this one book, but obviously the title it's a deliberate a reference to Rancière's volume, our title. So the basic point of the book, I suppose, is that democracy since the very beginning, in other words, since its origins in ancient Greece, has been bound up with a certain dislike or hatred for its messiness. And that's even among those who support it. So even among those who think that democracy is the best form of political regime, there's a kind of hatred, a kind of antipathy, a degree of discomfort with its kind of messiness. And it's messy in the sense that democratic government, as opposed to other types of government, oligarchy, meritocracy, tyranny, or, you know, and so forth, democracy as a regime involves people governing who don't have any particular skills or aptitudes or qualities that mean they should govern. And so they govern for a period of time, and then governing passes to others who similarly lack skills or particular aptitudes. So in other words, there's no identity in democracy. There's no identity of people who are destined to govern. You know, it's government of anyone by anyone and everybody by everybody, if you like. So in that sense, it's disruptive of a principle of social orderliness as a regime. And that in Rancière's account, that goes to explain some of the kind of the hatred, the discomfort that people feel about democracy, even as I say, those who support it. So we identify in the book then, in Hatred of Sex, we identify a parallel here with sex. So sex, when it's good, is disorderly, is disordering of our values, our identities, particular identities, our sense of social self-regard, if you like. And so in that sense, it's analogous to democracy. I say analogous, but in fact, there's a little bit more than an analogy or parallel, because in the very last chapter, the concluding chapter to the book, where we begin to talk about the hatred of democracy in the United States today. I mean, when I say today, I mean really since the first Trump presidency. So we talk about the storming of the U.S. Capitol and still ongoing refusal to accept the results of the last presidential election. And we look at the way in which that kind of hatred of democracy that all of those movements or manifestations express can be related to the hatred of sex, can be attributed to the hatred of sex. And so we look at, in particular, one of the sort of structuring fantasies of the QAnon movement, this idea that there is a kind of cult, it's completely lurid, outlandish notion, that there is a kind of cult of predatory paedophiles in government, in the establishment, and that Donald J. Trump has somehow been sent to kind of purge the world of this. And so it's a kind of lurid fantasy, but it is a kind of core structuring fantasy of this significant movement on the right and outright. So there we see that as coming from hatred of sex, in the sense that the kind of the figure of the paedophile in the US rose to prominence, particularly in the 1990s, the predatory paedophile. So in anti-sexual predator legislation that was enacted in the early 1990s, in a great kind of spirit of sort of elated cross-party consensus, which brought in some of the most draconian legislation really ever enacted. So legislation that actually created new provisions of administrative law, as opposed to kind of juridical law, to deal with a particular type of criminal. And so what that moment really attuned everyone to, I think, in the US, was the idea that in order to protect vulnerable children, it was possible to suspend ordinary politics and to suspend the law. And that is precisely how kind of that leads into the QAnon fantasy and, you know, the kind of anti-democratic, the hatred of democracy that's you know, still very much alive in the US and elsewhere today.
This analogical connection between hatred of sex and hatred of democracy is very interesting. I mean, you describe this hatred of democracy as being constitutive of democracy since its origins in ancient Greece. And likewise, that there's the same feature to our relationship to sex, to sexuality. There's a constitutive hatred of it. It's built in. And so it seems as though it's not going anywhere. Help me understand that better. Why it's a constitutive hatred that it can't go away. What about for people who are very into sex and very, you know, sex loving and sex positive?
Well, Matt, we include those people in our critique. That is, we aspire to. You could say we're being universalist, or you could say we're being inclusive in the way that we are encouraged to be inclusive in our culture today. That is, we're talking about sex and hatred rather than the standard pairing of sex and love. I think what's constitutive about this, as you take that term from our book, is that sexual pleasure has a propensity that is inbuilt to it to unbind psychic structures, to disrupt psychic structures such as the ego. And therefore, there is something about our egos. Even when we love sex, we also hate it, because there is an antithetical structure to the ego and the unbinding force of sexuality. The ego is, of course, psychoanalytically understood as a bound structure. And, you know, the point that I would add to what Oliver has just said about the sexual predator legislation of the 1990s is that it was profoundly anti-psychoanalytic in its refusal to think about childhood sexuality, infantile sexuality, as Freud talked about it. And I think Oliver is right to gesture to that collection of essays, The War on Sex, but that book is itself notable for what? It's like 600-700 pages, and he never mentions Freud. He never mentions psychoanalysis. That is to say, part of the problem with that legislation was its refusal to understand sexuality psychoanalytically. And part of the reaction to it is the refusal to understand sexuality psychoanalytically. And I think it's something to do with the fact of the infantile, what Freud called the infantile efflorescence of sexuality in childhood that makes it overwhelming to the structures of the ego. That is, we talk about sexual intensity, we talk about sexual excess, we talk about what's extreme in sexuality. Psychoanalytically, that is what sexuality is. It's not that it's usually normative and mild, it's that it's by definition excessive. And it's that is very hard to like and be comfortable with in a consistent way.
Now, as I was reading this book and thinking about the ways in which our dislike for sex can easily, as the book traces, cause us to find ways to, you know, drop it out of discourse or move into other directions. I wondered about, well, when I sort of coming up in my own training as an analyst and as a, you know, scholar, researcher, the discourse around sex and sexuality and psychoanalysis seemed kind of built in together. When I think about queer theory and psychoanalysis together, I think that, you know, sex and its excessiveness and what's interesting about that, its efflorescence, it's built in. It's part of it. You can't think one without the other. But the book is tracing a number of ways in which sex and sexuality have kind of dropped out of discourse. And I'm wondering about that. I mean, from your perspective, what happened to this disordering aspect of sexuality in the discourse around sex? It found expression in the work of LaPlanche very significantly, Leo Bersani as well, and both of them get significant attention in this book. But was it left out along the way? Has it never really been included to begin with? Is it subject to what LaPlanche, what you refer to in the book as just going astray? Where has it gone? Where did it go?
Matt, I think that question gets to the heart of the problem. And, you know, LaPlanche argues that even in Freud's own thinking, the capacity of sex to unbind and disorder gets forgotten, even by Freud himself, as he develops a theory of narcissism. So we have a situation in which the culture's deep suspicion of sex, the reversion to something like Puritanism, as Oliver referred to it, works in concert with any individual ego's tendency to forget that which is mostly unconscious, that which is unbound and particularly unbinding. So there is, in the sense that we're describing something that is constitutive, we're also, in talking about the forgetting of it, the losing of it, talking about something that is to some degree inevitable, right? And so what we're trying to do is bring that back into the light and to show that even discourses, the university discourse of queer theory has been kind of complicit in the forgetting of sex in the name of various kinds of identities. Or one would say, another answer to your question is to say that what happened was identity. What happened was people's commitment to identity, to understanding themselves in identitarian terms, which also has always seemed to me profoundly unpsychoanalytic.
Would it be accurate then to describe the book in part as a psychoanalytically oriented critique of I guess what we call identity politics now?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, it would. And I guess I would also add to what Tim's just said that, you know, obviously administering power, governing power, likes to think in terms of identity. Identity is what is how it administers and organizes us, and it's how corporate power, which is not unrelated to governing power, of course, sells us stuff. So, yeah, it is a psychoanalytic critique of identity in this sphere. Yeah, absolutely.
When we're locatable, then we can be administered, right? When we can be found and plotted on a grid, then we can be sold to, and we can be administered.
Absolutely. Yeah. When we can be known and known in all of our facets. And of course, you know, techniques of kind of algorithmically driven techniques of, you know, machinic techniques for kind of knowing us in these ways have proliferated in the last 50 years, which lends a kind of new impetus to that, to the kind of identitarian side, if you like, and that makes critique of it, deconstruction of it all the more urgent, I would say.
And I would just, you know, I would just add, Matt, that I think on the left and in various aspects of various, let's say, pockets of queer culture, there is the idea that the way to resist the kinds of the formations of power that we're describing is to invent new subversive, resistant identities, to create one's own identities. And I think that that actually perpetuates the problem rather than solving it. The solution to this problem is not through the defiles of identity. It's not to proliferate identities is to compound the problem, not to solve anything. So I think that political projects to political liberation projects based on identity seem to me extremely limited, if not doomed. I think the project of psychoanalysis, psychotherapy should not be to reinforce people's identities or to help them discover new identities. I think identity in toto is the problem.
Thinking about that reminds me of an important idea that comes up in this book. Thinking about the idea, you know, what you said, Tim, that it shouldn't be a way of inventing new subversive identities or better identities that is going to get us somewhere or get us, you know, somewhere better. That might not be helpful at all and probably isn't. There's this idea in the book, you know, likewise that sex, given our hatred for it, it isn't something nonetheless that should be redeemed or made lovable. Something about its ugliness, its messiness, shouldn't be recuperated. That comes through strongly in the book. It shouldn't be recuperated. And I wonder if you could say a little bit more about that. Why is it important not to redeem it, not to try to, I don't know, make sex better?
You know, I think, you know, psychoanalytically, redemption is always a form of binding, right? To redeem something is to bind it, to make it acceptable, to make it likable, to make it lovable, to make it palatable, to make it somehow aesthetically acceptable. And I think that the impulse to redeem sex, I understand it. I think it's extremely strong, but it is itself a binding impulse. And in binding that, which is the force of unbinding, what it gets rid of is sex itself, right? That is, what is lost in the redemptive act is sex. That is, not sexual acts, not sexual activity, but the capacity of sex to unbind, which we talk about in the book in terms of, we sort of appropriate, we adapt the notion of deplorability from Hillary Clinton's comment about Trump supporters. And I think what we're interested in there is, what do you do with the deplorables? Really, what do we do with the deplorable parts of ourselves? How do we come to terms with them without simply cleaning them up, making them acceptable, disciplining them, making them good, making them tractable? How do we deal with our own deplorability without simply eliminating it or projecting it onto somebody else?
I want to talk. There's a great many things that are going on in this book. It's a very very rich text for being very compact, and there are many, to my mind, like wonderful critiques of some of the things we're already talking about, of identity politics and the ways in which identities kind of serve to make us more administrable, the problematic ways in which trying to bind sex is unhelpful. And you also address the limitations of intersectionality, which is connected to the identity politics, as well as some of the more perhaps malevolent implications of the Me Too movement. I wish that we had time to talk about all of these things, but I'm curious especially about the latter chapters of the book, where your focus turns particularly to attachment theory and to traumatology. Hatred of sex is very critical of attachment theory, which you refer to at one point as a bureaucratic cancellation of psychoanalysis, which I thought was such a good way of capturing it. What in your view makes attachment theory inimical to psychoanalysis and also to democracy?
Thanks, Matt. That's a great question. In a way, it's kind of all of chapter three that I kind of need to run through. So I'll try and do that succinctly. So Bowlby's attachment theory, John Bowlby's attachment theory that he developed in the mid 20th century alongside Mary Salter Ainsworth, forms the bedrock really of dominant ways today of understanding child psychological development across the board, really. But perhaps not in sort of some psychoanalytic corners, but I think it is socially and culturally dominant in a way that perhaps psychoanalytic accounts aren't, at least aren't in most places any longer. And so it's the bedrock also of the kind of traumatology that Judith Herman and others in particular have pioneered. But attachment theory actually we find is extremely deterministic and also a totalizing theory. So it finds in the child's early attachment relationship with, well, what is usually called the primary caregiver, but is invariably the mother, the defining template for the adult personality. And while within attachment therapy itself can do some sort of remedial work if things go wrong in that early formative phase, it's kind of really tinkering around the edges, and in a very strong sense, I think, that doesn't apply in the same way in forms of psychoanalysis proper. This is a kind of deterministic theory of personality development. Anyway, that's just to contextualize it a little bit. So one of the kind of things that we found looking at the kind of the way in which attachment therapy came about was that the idea of security is something that Salter Ainsworth, Mary Salter Ainsworth in particular, fed into attachment theory. And she kind of adapted it from the work of William Blatz, who was her psychologist, who was her supervisor and also her mentor, who had this notion of kind of human security in his work. But one of the things that's very interesting that happens when Ainsworth and Salter Ainsworth and Bowlby take on this idea of security from Blatz is that instead of, so in Blatz, which seems to be quite a sensible perspective. Blatt understood human beings as being able to be secure in certain areas of their life and very insecure in other areas of their life. But what happens for when in attachment theory is security becomes something that you either have or you don't. So it's a kind of total defining characteristic of the person. And it's from here we get notions of the colloquial talk of a bit somebody being very insecure. You know, this kind of comes from attachment theory, really. So in other words, to be securely or insecurely attached, or I mean, there are lots of sort of more, as it were, precise variants on the typologies within attachment theory. But this is a kind of total personality type for attachment theory. Now, there are lots of problems with attachment theory. Feminists have identified problems with attachment theory long before us. So mothers get blamed basically for most of the suffering in the world, but according to attachment theory. I mean, not explicitly, obviously, but that's the implication. But what one of the things we identified was the sheer arbitrariness of the principal focus of Bowlby and Salter Ainsworth's empirical work. And that of the Tavistock Clinic where they were based. So they chose what they called separation as the kind of main focus of their empirical work. And so this was what happened when infants and children in this sort of sensitive formative years were separated for various, and partly it had to do with wartime evacuations from cities in the UK. This was part of the kind of impetus for the work, but separation of various kinds became for them the kind of the principal cause of pathology in later development. But that was a totally arbitrary choice of focus. And Bowlby, if you read Bowlby carefully, he admits to it in the work. He says, we chose separation because we had to choose something, and separation could be easily observed. So separation was chosen for the convenience of getting funding to run these projects to develop this work. Separation was, you know, it's like separation is, you know, it's an incredibly kind of wide, general, malleable, adaptable concept, just like attachment, actually. And this is part of the problem, I think, with attachment theories. It sounds so innocuous. You know, who could object to attachment? But actually, part of the problem with it is it's kind of the way it can be ubiquitously redeployed. So anyway, feminists have a problem with it. Separation is a kind of arbitrary choice in the theory. But in terms of the relation to psychoanalysis, this is key, I think, because separation was something you could easily observe. And Bowlby and Salter Ainsworth, what they like to do is they like to observe rather than listen to the children that they were engaged with. So the sort of, if you like, the aesthetic, the sensory modality of attachment theory is observation. It's a surveillant visualist modality. It's not a psychoanalytic modality. It's not anything to do with kind of listening to somebody talk and express themselves.
As you
said, it was compact, our book. It's quite imbricated, particularly in this chapter. So I'm just trying to pull out some of these threads. So in terms of the relationship with psychoanalysis, so there is this surveillant visualist sensory modality, which contrasts with the Freudian psychoanalytic modality, obviously. But also, whereas for Freud, for Freudian, Lacanian, Laplanchian, and other types of psychoanalysis proper, conflict, intrapsychic conflict within the psyche, is just part of the human condition. And, you know, what therapy is there for is to kind of help us understand these conflicts and live them and perhaps tolerate them without so much suffering. But the conflicts kind of don't go away. For attachment theory, intrapsychic conflict is produced by deficiencies in the caregiving environment in the formative years. So basically for the kind of implication of within attachment theory was that if you could readminister the caregiving environment, in other words, readminister a portion of the material social world, political world, you could kind of eliminate intrapsychic conflict and eliminate suffering. And so it's a kind of utopian theory in a way.
Let me just interrupt one moment, Oliver, just to give you a moment's break. But it's a utopian theory that involves a kind of social engineering that would be all about eliminating the unconscious, right? It would be, as you say, about programming families, mothers, and children so that caregiving happens in the right way, and something like psychic conflict just disappeared. And there's something profoundly, it's utopian, but it's also profoundly dangerous in that idea of eliminating what is part and parcel of subjectivity.
Absolutely. And so in a way, there's a kind of implicit ideal of single-mindedness. Of single-mindedness and simple-mindedness, if you like, within attachment theory, and that lends it absolutely to projects of administering power in the post-war period. And the Tavistock Clinic, as you know, the work of Peter Miller and Nicholas Rose has shown very eloquently, was absolutely its mission really was to kind of re-engineer British society for that post-war world. And so if you have single-minded individuals, you know, who are securely attached, they can be slotted into the system of administering power quite smoothly, in a way that, you know, kind of psych, the two-minded, ambivalent, never quite sure where they are individuals that, you know, in a certain reading kind of Freudian psychoanalysis gives us, that they're much less governable. It's much harder to govern them. And so, I mean, and then just to bring it back to Hatred of Sex, finally, for me, then attachment theory is what we say about it in chapter three. We sort of read that you mentioned Me Too, and obviously we're not against Me Too, but we are skeptical about some of the kind of cumulative side effects, if you like, unintended consequences of this, as with other movements. So one of the things we were interested in was where this idea of what appropriateness in sexual relating is, where's it coming from? And it's not just something that's vectored by Me Too, but it was vectored, I think, by Me Too, is vectored by Me Too, but also it's something embedded in a lot of kind of consent-based sex ed programs in across campuses and in schools, so what we call schools in Britain, but in educational establishments anyway. So where does this idea of appropriateness come from in healthy sexual relatedness? And we kind of came to the conclusion it sort of comes from attachment theory. And it comes from attachment theory because attachment theory models adult sexual relationships, romantic relationships, on the relationship between the infant and the primary caregiver. So in terms of the relationship between the infant and the secure base, if you like. And so what that actually means is that the sort of healthy sexual relatedness on that model is a model of fairly intermittent sex in the context of a marriage-like relationship, an intimate monogamous relationship. And so any other kind of sex, if you like, promiscuous sex, lots of the kinds of sex that when Gail Rubin developed her wonderful idea of the charmed circle, you know, that lie on the kind of outer reaches of that circle, those kinds of sex are viewed with suspicion as dangerous. And those who engage in them or suspected of engaging with them are more intensively watched and policed. So attachment theory gets the blame for all of that.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
It's remarkable, and I mean, you underline this both here and in the book, the kind of militarized language that is built into attachment theory that is very innocuous on the surface, right? You don't really hear it, and so you start listening for it, right? But the idea of the secure base, and you know, corollary to that, the idea that the world out there is kind of naturally threatening, right? Harmful. There's danger out there, and we have to be protected. It starts to help flesh in, you know, this general feeling, I think, that we're in, you know, in the United States and elsewhere, that we have to be on guard at all times. The enemy could be coming from everywhere.
I think that comes in a way, it comes from partly from a kind of the way in which, you know, in the 1970s, government started to measure not just the experience of being a victim of crime, but the fear of crime. So among ordinary citizens who hadn't been victims of crime. So that allowed something quite inchoate around fear and security, the kind of ego's fear of being overcome, to enter into political discourse and to become a thing within political discourse. And I think that in turn led, and I mean, it's not a totally original set of claims, it's something David Garland and other critical criminologists have been saying for a long time, but this allowed politicians then to make quite exorbitant promises of security, and to try and outbid each other competitively in this sort of cycle or spiral. And I think to my mind, that explains kind of rightwards drift in our political systems much better than a lot of the other accounts for that that movement do. So just to say that I think, yeah, that, you know, we're very accustomed to thinking about security as a good thing. I think reading Bowlby and reading, you know, reading the way in which, you know, his experiences, you know, as an officer in the Second World War, you know, there are some really, really military examples in you know, in his great trilogy, or his big trilogy, that really, really point to the kind of militarism that attachment theory wired into its own set of beliefs, and then into the wider culture.
And I think that, just to add to what Oliver is saying, I think that those militarized metaphors and the intensifying push towards security and securitization absolutely goes along with a psychoanalytic critique of the ego as a fortified structure, as a structure that worked through defenses, right? That is known by its defense mechanisms, that is, its very structure and the way it operates is entirely compatible with a militaristic view of the world.
It's interesting just, you know, listening and thinking about the fear of danger out there, you know, that has emerged in the political discourse, and, you know, what you're talking about, politicians who seize on this so much. I mean, literally up to this minute, earlier today, I was reading the headlines about the midterms here next week and how it's become the, you know, overarching concern of voters, apparently, you know, the possibility of crime that we're most preoccupied with right now. It's very effective. So there's a lot to say about attachment theory. At the same time, attachment theory, your critique of attachment theory, forms the foundation, the base, as it were, for a larger critique that you start to make in the next chapter of the book, which is about traumatology, or what I might call in my day-to-day, like trauma-focused care, trauma-focused therapies, but traumatology. And the movement that the book traces, you describe the ways in which traumatology kind of takes the already most problematic aspects of attachment theory as you see them and radicalizes them and weaponizes them. Traumatology really emerges as a kind of, well, when you start to say weapon, as a really almost like dangerous, there's an element of danger to traumatology that we are not so aware of.
Yes. I mean, just give you one example of that. I mean, I suppose the sort of the one-dimensional ideal of single-mindedness in attachment theory, you know, so the idea that there is no, if there's intrapsychic conflict, it's the fault of the caregiving environment. So in trauma-focused, in the kind of traumatology, you know, obviously we read trauma and recovery among other works in the book. So things like multiple personality disorder, you know, alters and fragmentation, that the kind of fragmentation that is theorized to be a result of prototypically child sexual abuse, but also other kinds of sexual trauma. So that is very, very, very clearly a kind of radicalization of the position with attachment theory that sees intrapsychic conflict as products of the deficiency in the early caregiving environment.
And just to, like, you know, get at what you're asking about, Matt, from a slightly different angle, the way that we are trying to describe sexuality psychoanalytically as something, as a force of unbinding following Laplanche, as something that therefore disrupts or violates the ego, can make the intensity of sexual pleasure seem dramatic in itself, right? That is to say, one could even go so far as to say that the better the sex, the more intense the sex, the more likely it is to be traumatic in some way. And I think that what we're trying to do is disarticulate that phenomenon from the discourse of sexual abuse. Right? That is, if I'm overwhelmed, even traumatized by my own pleasure, that doesn't mean that I'm being abused or assaulted by somebody else. And I think that it can be very, very difficult, especially for young people, to come to terms with that distinction, which I think is a psychoanalytic distinction, but it's to say that sex, the intensity of sexual pleasure, can be harmful to my ego, to my own defenses, but that doesn't mean that somebody else is harming me. And it's a tricky distinction to make, but I think it's a crucial one for the politics that we're trying to advocate and intervene in.
It is a crucial distinction, and it's a distinction that's difficult to make, partly because of the commodification of traumatized identity that traumatology has kind of either not noticed or kind of, you know, not critiqued itself, and so the idea to kind of curate the identity of as a victim of trauma, a survivor of trauma, is a way to accrue attention in the marketplace of social attention, and traumatology has been extremely successful in curating traumatized identity, and this leads people to think that they have been traumatized in situations where, you know, they might just have had very good sex, or they might just have had a kind of unusual experience. Not in a kind of proper sense, a kind of traumatic experience. So I think there's a dynamic within traumatology itself that has made that distinction that we want to insist on harder to draw.
Right. And I think that's exactly right. And I just want to give a shout out to our colleague and friend Avi Sakadapulo, whose book Sexuality Beyond Consent will be out shortly, and I'm sure you will try to get her on your podcast, Matt. She's making an argument there about Viola Planche, about trauma, about sexuality, about consent, and trying to develop a concept of traumatophilia to combat this idea that to combat exactly what we are talking about in other terms.
It sounds like it's interesting with a trauma coalescing and being commodified into an identity. I mean, trauma is, it seems to have sort of like a halo around it. It's untouchable, right? And once you can identify as having a trauma or a traumatized identity, there's license for kind of specialized forms of recognition and treatment, as well as even this idea in terms of treatment from a clinical perspective, that some of the maybe like otherwise ethical boundaries might be more elastic, right? There's an idea, you know, that we should really be very forthcoming in informing people about their trauma if they have had a traumatic experience, or if the clinician suspects that they might.
Absolutely.
Which all bets are off.
Yeah, which when the clinician gets it right, you know, is okay, more or less. One might take exception to it on other kind of therapeutic grounds, but you know, when they get it right, it's okay. But there is throughout trauma and recovery, there is a kind of repeated exploitation. There's a suggestion throughout trauma recovery that you know, there is likely to be trauma, in sexual trauma most especially. In case histories, even where it's not on the surface. And it's the therapist's job, absolutely, as you say, Matt, to according to that kind of way of thinking, to unearth and pinpoint and actually suggest to the patient that this is part of their experience, and that can be very problematic in all sorts of ways.
And you know, for your listeners, Matt, who might be thinking, you know, well, look, they're here, these guys just simply minimizing trauma and not understanding what I myself have gone through. I want to say that our goal, our aim is not to minimize trauma, but it's to say the trauma is not and cannot be the explanation for everything. And the way that traumatology has worked in the culture, and the way the popular culture works in our trauma, in our culture, is to make trauma the explanation for everything, so that people who never heard of psychoanalysis, they know all about trauma, they can talk about trauma. People who have not been to college can talk about trauma. It's become a kind of go-to idea within the culture, which is a way of mobilizing resources for oneself. It's a way of attaching to an identity, as Oliver describes. It becomes the explanation for everything. And it's a way of saying, it can be used as a way of saying, I, in fact, have no responsibility for what has happened. I myself do not have aggressive or rapacious or appropriative impulses. I am, in fact, wholly innocent and somebody who is just done to, rather than somebody who does things to other people. And so there's a way in which trauma as a concept is used to avoid responsibility for the impulses we all have, which are the least appealing to our own egos, our own sense of ourselves, right? Trauma is a way of avoiding, claiming to have been traumatized is a way of avoiding one's own deplorability, one's own wish to to fuck and to kill, which let's just say are, you know, understood in Freud right from the beginning as part of what it means to be human, not part of what it means to be a man, part of what it means to be human. And I think we live in a culture that wants us to disavow those impulses, attribute them to other people, people we don't like, social groups we don't like, and then they run amok because nobody's actually taking responsibility for their own unattractive impulses. Nobody's owning them.
I think that distinction that you mark earlier, Tim, is an important one. It's not that the book aims to diminish or set aside the importance of trauma or the experience of people who have had very traumatic experiences, as much as the critique seems to be aimed at applying some breaks maybe to the emotional momentum, the movement of traumatology in our culture and the way in which it has really, as you say, become an explanation for everything, the ease with which that happens and the quickness with which it's possible for us to leap to that now.
And within the field of sex as well, you know, what we argue is that there's a kind of whole domain of what we call that which is kind of benignly sexually inappropriate, but that is falls short of traumatic or abusive, and that's a distinction. I mean, that will be a controversial distinction, I think, for a lot of people. But what we're saying is that kind of the traumatology and the kind of popular cultural fetishization of trauma have led to the recoding of all sorts of forms of sort of sexual awkwardness and weirdness that, you know, decades ago we might have called queer, being recoded as traumatic and or traumatogenic and abusive, and that so just sketching that kind of differentiation is for us an important move as well, and it's obviously it's going to be provocative and it's going to upset some people. We understand that.
And you know, in terms of queer theory and politics, part of what we're seeing is that the appropriate has become the new normal, right? That is a category that is wielded to discipline and subjugate and get rid of all the things you don't like, both in yourself and in the people around you, right? By coding things as not appropriate, that's exactly the way that normal used to function before the queer critique of normal, which I think was a tremendously important critique and seems to have sort of fallen away in the resurgence of this new version of the normal, which is, quote unquote, the appropriate.
Just tracing that, you know, movement from the normal to the appropriate, it made me wonder what it, I don't know, what it's like to observe that happening. I mean, time was, you know, during an earlier stage in queer theory, right? The critique of normal was very prevalent. I mean, Michael Warner's book from back then, The Trouble with Normal, was, you know, probably like the touchstone book for really drawing the problematics of norms and normality into the open. What's it like? Is it surprising? Is it just to see, I don't know, appropriateness kind of supplant and substitute and maybe like deepen the same kinds of, hatreds that norms used to sort of help set up and police?
There's been a redistribution of repressive energies, is what I'd say. Migration and redistribution.
Let's see, we're going to be closing in a few minutes. I'm glad that you had mentioned the concept of benign sexual inappropriateness. It seems like it's an important way of trying to kind of broaden the discourse, open up the space for there being ways to actually verbalize, speak about, and understand a broader range of sexual experiences, as well as our own conflicted, you know, experiences of those experiences. Before we wrap, there was one question that I wanted to ask. You point out importantly that where sex has come to be defined or understood often as something that is, harmful, dangerous, potentially abusive, that has to be guarded against, that sex needs to be redefined in terms of pleasure. I think this conversation has in its ways been about that need. But I'm curious, since on the bleaker days, it seems like this period of hatred around sex being so visible is going to be around for some time. Even during the course of time that I was reading this book and preparing this interview, dramatic political legislative changes here in the United States in terms of like Roe v. Wade, which I just thought, oh, we're on the march, right? This is part of it. But I don't know, are there places in culture or elsewhere where you currently see this redefinition of sex as pleasure happening?
I will just say I'm not sure I have a great answer to that question in terms of places in culture, but I do think the pleasure is tremendously important, especially pleasure that cannot be harnessed to any economic or political agenda. I think part of the way capitalism works is by trying to co-opt and make use of, instrumentalize all of our pleasures to make money. So I think we need to be able to think about, hold on to a place for non-utilitarian pleasures, pleasure for its own sake, and also to understand that kind of pleasure, which is worth cultivating, can still be unstable, right? Can still be dangerous in some way. But what is dangerous to is the fortifications of my own identity, right? To the rigidity of identity. And I think it's too easy to make the mistake of thinking that pleasure can be harnessed to a political agenda. I'm skeptical that it can. Although this may be a place where Oliver and I don't always agree.
I mean, I suppose sort of in the recent past, certainly in the kind of early years of combination therapy barebacking, something that Tim's worked on a lot would have been a way of might have been a kind of sort of sexual subculture that that there would be hope for the kind of pleasurableness of sex kind of overriding its dangerousness and or the danger being part of the pleasure. I guess chemsex subcultures in kind of gay male subcultures, particularly also women involved in chemsex, although it's not always called chemsex. I guess kink and BDSM subcultures are still thriving in a way. There was a very interesting series of four podcasts by some folks at a podcast called Drunk Church that came out last week, I think. I listened to them last weekend anyway. Cosima B. Concordia and Aurora Laban, and clearly our book resonated with some of their experiences, and they're very involved in, it sounds like anyway, in those kinds of subcultures. So that was really heartening to hear that it resonated with their interest in pleasure and pleasure in spite of and alongside danger, if you like.
And just to kind of like throw in a little plug for the people of Drunk Church. I was sort of intrigued by these people I do not know and that Oliver does not know, sort of doing a series of podcasts on our book, Hatred of Sex, but without reaching out to us, without wanting to interview us, without consulting us as ostensible authorities on the book. And I think, in fact, that's a tremendously good sign that they were not interested in us as authorities. They just wanted to do something with the ideas in the book and run with it in their own directions. And I really enjoy talking to you, Matt, and I'm enjoying this conversation, but I also completely applaud the folks who run with this in whichever direction seems to them most enjoyable.
I love that idea that, the book and the ideas in the book are starting to take on a life of their own. There needn't be the participation of the writers of the book as masters of the discussion in order to continue exploring those ideas and deepening them and seeing where it is that they're going to go.
Absolutely.
Well, Oliver and Tim, we're going to have to draw to a close, but this conversation has been wonderful, if entirely too short. I wish that we could go longer. Before we have to end, I'm curious what projects the two of you might be working on now.
So I'm writing a book on the politics of psychedelics, on the politics of the psychedelic renaissance. And a part of that is actually looking at the idea of psychedelic treatments for trauma.
I'm working on a range of projects. I feel that none of them is quite as interesting as Oliver's psychedelic project, but at the moment I'm trying to write a piece about the history of AIDS literature, which I'm calling What Was AIDS Literature, to think about to think about AIDS vis-a-vis a certain understanding of temporality, which would be a psychoanalytic understanding of temporality. And I'm also writing a piece on my own relationship over the last 30 years to queer theory and my cantankerous arguments with some of the key figures in queer theory and trying to reassess that.
All of these projects sound fascinating. I would look forward to having you on down the road when the work around them has been published.
It'll be a pleasure. Thanks so much. Thanks so much for inviting us.
And thank you very much for joining me today, both of you. And I would like to take a moment also to thank our listeners for joining in. Until next time.
Thank you.